Welcome to Grumpy Strategists 2025. This is episode 31, but the first of the new year. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined by the head of research here at Strategic Analysis Australia, Marcus Hellyer.
Hello, Michael. Happy New Year. And I'd also like to welcome all of our listeners back. It's great to be doing another episode. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in and listening to us.
Yes, thanks to both of you for coming back and joining us this year.
I know one of the listeners is my mum. I'm not sure who the other one is, though.
But it's my uncle.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so a big shout out to Uncle David. So really today we're going to talk about the US. You know, it's Inauguration Day. So
who's being inaugurated?
I think there's a new president that is being sworn in today.
The old president, new again.
Yeah, something old and something new, something borrowed and something blue. And we'll talk a bit about valedictory of Joe Biden. As we speak, he's still the US president, but
I think by the time
we edit this, he won't be.
No.
A bit about some ideas about the Trump administration in Australia, and then a bit of while we're all sleeping. So the busy little elves in the Russell Defence Complex here in Canberra and broader government released even more documentation.
Santa did deliver a number of gifts for us down the chimney. I think they're more in the coal department than the shiny new toy department.
Well, I thought I must have been a very naughty boy with these gifts.
You're a very naughty boy, Michael.
Yeah, so we'll talk about some of those. And just remind me at the end, we are actually making a live appearance as the after-lunch entertainment at the Australian Defence Magazine's annual conference in February. I think it's the 19th of February.
It is indeed.
So if anyone wants to throw an actual tomato at us, we'll be there.
Or questions. There will be time for questions.
A question wrapped around a tomato. Yeah. So first of all, the US. So Biden, what did Joe Biden ever do for us?
Well, there is AUKUS. Now, again, depending on your point of view, that's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, if you sort of look into the archaeology of AUKUS, probably started under the previous Trump administration, but came to fruition under the Biden administration.
Well, he's one of the daddies, isn't he? So Boris Johnson is a daddy, Joe Biden's a daddy, and of course that fella that down under.
Morrison.
Last seen at Mar-a-Lago on New Year's Eve.
And Biden, about to go, but he was the last remaining survivor of the triumvirate for a while, and he's gone now. So the three fathers of AUKUS are now gone.
Well, it's fatherhood all over, isn't it? I mean, you bring a child into the world, you bring them up, but then you've got to let them go their own way, and AUKUS is now doing that.
I think that is the issue for all major policies. It has to stand on its own two feet. If it's a good policy, it will find supporters and sponsors. It can't depend on the initial fathers of it. If it relies simply on that, it's going to fail. And so we'll see.
Well, we'll talk a little bit when we're talking about Mr. Trump and the next 4 years. But think about what Biden did. So critics say he damaged American power by the way the withdrawal happened from Afghanistan. Other people remind you when you say that, but it was Trump's time and Trump's deal with the Taliban, Biden just put it into effect.
Yeah, well, it was Trump's decision, whether you like it or not. But I do think you have to say it was badly implemented, very badly implemented. And I do think that coming relatively early in his administration damaged his administration, not just amongst national security people, but the sight of US Marines getting blown up did not play well on the American street.
I think it damaged brand America. I think that's true. But after that, when Putin attacked Ukraine, Biden did a uniquely good job, in my view, in unifying NATO and rallying them very rapidly. And when Kiev didn't fall to the initial Russian attack, that support from the US and broader NATO was fundamental. Of course, the downside is after the initial rallying and support, he wrapped the Ukrainians up in so many constraints that his main plan seemed to be, what's the minimum I can do so that the Ukrainians don't lose?
Yeah, I don't think you have to go too far down rabbit holes on sites like X and similar sites to find people who are quite happily blaming the invasion on Biden, whether he was sort of too forward-leaning in sort of not denying Ukraine admittance to NATO, for example, or not pushing back on Putin. I mean, you have people blaming Biden for all kinds of reasons. But yeah, my sense is that after the invasion started, he did play a key role in pulling NATO together. And I have to say that I do think NATO was at risk of splintering over Ukraine.
And in a sort of counterfactual, counter-history, alternative history, imagine if Donald Trump had been the US president at the time Putin did that attack. Can anyone imagine Trump being the unifying figure for NATO in that moment?
Yeah, and I think at this moment, you know, NATO is about as strong as ever, and it's bigger than ever with
Finland,
the admission of
Sweden.
Finland and Sweden. Now, what's going to become? I don't think Trump's going to withdraw from NATO anytime soon, but alliances are strong when there are clear messages from the lead partners there, and you're not really getting that out of Trump at the moment.
Biden probably strengthened the foundations of NATO.
I agree with that.
Mainly thanks to Vladimir Putin, but Biden's actions did have that effect. What about the Middle East? Because the other, you know, the Trump campaign said, well, Biden's weakness caused both wars. You know, the war in Ukraine wouldn't have happened and Hamas wouldn't have attacked if Trump had been in the White House because he's so strong.
Well, again, I'm not quite sure about that either. I'm not sure whether Hamas's decision to attack Israel was really driven by an assessment of
who was
Biden's
in the White House
weakness or otherwise. You know, the people have a vote. It's not simply the person sitting in the Oval Office who determines what happens in the world. And so there
are
a lot of people
out
there.
Both Putin and Hamas is where they rule, they vote. So my view is Putin caused the war in Ukraine and Hamas decided to do the 7th of October attacks. Of course, there's a backstory to both, but the decision makers that started both those conflicts were Vladimir Putin and the Hamas leadership.
Well, and I think it simply shows the limits on the power of any superpower. We go all the way back to, you know, 2003 when the second Bush administration decided to invade Iraq, driven by this sort of neocon view that they could reshape the Middle East into this kind of liberal order. Well, I mean, that was always doomed to fail because the US can't simply shape the world the way
it
wants
it to
be. Well,
and that was at a time when everybody was seized of the US being so powerful, it was the unipolar moment. So if the US at that high point of its global power couldn't shape events every way it wanted to, why on earth can we even begin to think it makes sense to ascribe the war in Ukraine and the war in the Middle East to who was in the White House?
Now, what along those lines, if we look closer to home in the Indo-Pacific, I think that kind of tacit and sometimes overt US acknowledgement of its limitations has led to a kind of reinvigoration in the Indo-Pacific, not just of the US's direct alliances with its partners, the classic hub and spoke arrangement, but there's also been a reinvigoration of alliances or partnerships between US allies.
Some of the rim, the spokes have been joining up, not just through the hub
of
the US.
Yeah, so it's becoming a network as opposed to, you know, this traditional arrangement. And I think that's a good thing, and I think the Biden administration has been pushing hard.
Well, I think it was deliberate. You'll hear, if you look back over Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's speeches, he talks about the lattice approach to alliances and partnerships. They actively wanted the Japanese and the South Koreans to work more closely together with or without the US. Same between Japan and Australia, South Korea and Australia and the Philippines. So that, I think, is another legacy that Biden and the Biden administration will leave behind. That's a good thing. And arguably, as America gets even more America-firsty and more selfish, then these individual relationships between partners and allies without the US become even more important.
I'd agree with that. Though, you know, we're going to see where these relationships go under Trump. But we'll get to that. We'll finish on Biden on one point, and it is a criticism of him. And I do think that by not declaring that he was going to be a one-term president, and in fact, the deeper we went into his presidency, the more it sort of became apparent he was going to try and hang on. I think that really hamstrung the Democratic Party. When he was kind of kicked out by his own people, it was too late. They didn't have a real primary process. The Democrat Party really couldn't have a process that kind of generated the best candidate. Now, I don't think Kamala was a terrible candidate, but I don't really think she was the best candidate that the Democratic Party could have come up with. So,
no, if you remember, when Biden started his term, he actually did give a commitment to be a one-term president.
Yeah.
And, I think I've heard you say if he'd kept to that, he'd be seen as a hero of American democracy and the Democratic Party. He was the antidote to Trump. Lots of people have lots of views about this, but I tend to agree that when he started musing about staying for a second term. And then it all got so blurry and vague. And by the time he stepped away, was forced to step away, the clock was out for anyone who came after him to be a viable candidate. He actually really accentuated the momentum around Trump getting back. So when history looks back, there'll be that alternative history that says, if you'd done what he said at the start, said, I'm a one-term president, and let the Democrats do their primaries and have a strong candidate with plenty of time, maybe things would be different here on the 20th of January 2025. But they're not.
I agree. And I think history will judge him harshly on that issue.
Yeah. So that's the good, the bad, and the ugly from about Joe Biden. And certainly I'd say I think he was deeply sincere in his commitment to America and public life, and in fact to allies. Turning to Donald Trump 2.0, well, I think if you think about his first term, he didn't expect to become the president. He didn't think he had a divine right to be the president. And he didn't think he knew enough to be president. So he surrounded himself with experienced advisors who were all called the adults in the room. You know, people like General Jim Mattis in the Pentagon, Rex Tillerson, and then Mike Pompeo in State.
That has fundamentally changed. I think all of
Bolton
those...
Bolton as National Security Advisor, McMaster. Even over his first term, he slowly railed against all these adults telling him what to do and kick them all out. Now, he has been anointed by God, saved from the assassin's bullet by, in his own words, divine intervention. And he's
very Louis the 16th, I would say. But
well, he's a big Francophile. And he's now absolutely certain that his own instincts and judgment are better than anybody. And to me, he stacked his administration with discordant voices so that he gets all the room to make whatever decision he wants.
Yeah, I think it is a very different Donald Trump this time round. Well, it's the same guy, but
it's
I don't
more,
think he has,
it's
any
more Trumpy.
Self-doubt.
More Trumpy than
more
the first
Trumpy.
One.
There is no self-doubt there. The so-called adults in the room, I think he'd just be thinking, they offered me no benefit whatsoever. They just got in the way of me implementing my agenda. So he's not having them in the room to start with.
Yep.
So,
yep.
But the people in the room, I agree, are very discordant. So you look at the people in the actual cabinet, and then you've sort of got this quasi-shadow cabinet, including Elon Musk. Because even though Elon Musk is running this department of...
government efficiency.
Efficiency. It's not actually a real government department,
no.
But he is actually trying to get an office inside the White House. So you sort of got this administration and the shadow administration.
It's the gray zone.
But, you know, they are very different. You know, numerous commentators have said this already. We're not saying anything new. You've sort of got the base, the Trumpy base, this sort of ethno-nationalist kind of base with personified by people like Steve Bannon.
Close the border, bring jobs back.
You know,
and dirty foreigners are taking advantage of us.
Not that Bannon is actually in the administration, which is part of the sort of shadow administration.
Yep.
And then you've got the tech bros, you know, embodied by Elon Musk.
But well, and a newly fanboy version of Mark Zuckerberg for Trump. He loves the guy. Committed to free speech like never before.
Yeah, all of the tech bros have come on board like nobody's business. But they have very different assumptions, very different drivers to the MAGA.
Well, you saw that with the stoush that Bannon and Musk had over H-1B visas, the critical skilled foreign visa program, where Elon and his tech bros are saying this is fundamental to our tech success here in America.
We want the smartest, you know, 0.1% of people in the world. And the ethno-nationalists are saying, but they're Indians.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not those people didn't make America great. It was white people.
Yeah, we're meant to be making America great ourselves. Yeah. So that's interesting. I think even another sort of level of discordant voice is the sort of Wall Street Treasury appointee, Besant, and people like Musk who've got such a stake in the Chinese economy, and then people like Marco Rubio at the State Department, Pete Hegseth and Waltz, his national security advisor, who are all seized of the military technological competition with China, want to see more technological controls put on China. And Musk is in the land of the opposite. Every Tesla people drive around the streets of Canberra and Australia, besides the early Model S, is built in China. So on China, there are polarized differences in the cabinet and in people just outside the cabinet like Musk. And again, I think that just means Trump gets to be the decider on everything.
Well, it gives him room because if there's a bad policy, he can say, well, that came from this guy.
Why don't I listen to Marco?
But, you know... We were going to try and get through this without mentioning Hitler, you know, and I'm not going to say that Trump is the reincarnation of Hitler, but it is a classic ploy of dictators to set up this situation where they have their mandarins beneath them squabbling away and they sit above it. And so the common folk can go, well, there's corruption here or there's poor policy here. But if the great leader, regardless of who it is, Hitler, Mussolini, because he's not the problem. It's all of these squabbling mandarins down here.
If only he knew. This is the, all our Chinese listeners will know, it's the distant emperor. Got the benevolent distant emperor. And if only they knew the things that the horrible local corrupt officials were doing, they would step in and do all the right things. So Trump set himself up to be that, hasn't he? A river to his people, if only they could get to him.
Now, there's been a lot of very disappointed, unhappy Democrats, you know, predicting that it's all going to end in tears as soon as Trump slaps on huge tariffs on other countries.
The scales will fall from the eyes of all of his supporters.
Yeah, they're realizing
why am I paying more higher prices at Walmart?
It's all going to end in tears. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I mean, that's the other feature of these kinds of regimes, is that people believe what they want to believe. You know? So I don't think all of a sudden the wheels are going to come off the Trump administration. So we are going to have this administration for a long time to come. I think we'll see changes fairly rapidly in the
makeup of the administration. Yep. I think people will come and go even faster than they did in the first term.
Now whether that's voluntarily because they sort of see the administration for what it is, or that Trump simply ejects them because they're getting too much attention.
Donald unhappy in some way. Yeah,
but I think Trump will certainly, they're not going to get rid of him. No one's going to get rid of Trump. So we've got him for the next 4 years.
Well, the interesting thing, though, is all of this discordance, whether it's in Trump's own mind or in the different people in powerful positions in the administration and in Congress, who of course have separate power, that is really a disruptive shakeup of the entire American political and government system. Mm. And one thing I like about that is the business as usual model was busted, and not just in America. In most democracies, that business as usual, we know how things work. You can choose whichever major party you like and they'll give you broadly the same thing. That is what American voters voted against, and that's probably what the French and German voters are voting against.
Well, people are voting for change, and it's not just the people who voted for Trump who wanted change. A lot of Democrat voters wanted change. They just didn't want it to be quite as radical, perhaps, as what Trump was bringing. Yeah. So I agree that Trump does have a mandate for change here. Of course, you know, once he starts doing those changes, there will be second and third order effects with people saying, oh, that's not exactly the change that I wanted. And we're going to see that, I think, at the international level, in the Indo-Pacific, where we start to see change, and people may be going, that's not exactly the change.
Yeah, I want
to
change, but not that. But I think this is where being a little bit open-minded to what is actually happening rather than what we want to have happen is important. So I can't imagine the next national defense strategy, which is apparently being written every 2 years, so we're only about a year away from one out of the Australian government, talking a lot about the rules-based global order, because there really isn't one now, is there? Who is the upholder of this chimerical, mythical thing?
Well, the rules-based global order. So, you know, you don't have to be Bernie Sanders or Noam Chomsky to sort of go, well, the rules-based global order was to a certain extent, even a large extent, a bit of a veneer to kind of cover up the exercise of US power.
Yeah, and you could, I think the US has been a very benign imperial power. It's actually given a lot of discretion and room to other actors in the system. Well, but I think that's been a choice.
You haven't been killed by a US bomb.
I agree. I've been a beneficiary of that.
So there are a lot of people out there who are not fans of that US-led global order, and certainly Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin. But I think what we're going to see is a lot of that veneer around the rules-based global order is going to be stripped away, and we are going to ultimately become realists, or we're going to see that realism truly is the way the world works. In a classic example, already before Trump is inaugurated, he's talking about annexing Greenland, threatening the use of force to do so.
Against the Danes, a NATO member.
Sort of making strange comments about somehow incorporating
the Canadians,
maybe not by force, but through some form of economic coercion, and also talking about taking back the Panama Canal by force if necessary.
Now, you've forgotten renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. So pretty much just seizing all the territory that's on the North American continent for America, plus a bit of offshore stuff like Greenland.
Yeah, it is sort of like we didn't quite get finished with Manifest Destiny. Yeah. We sort of got all the way to the Pacific, but we need to go a little bit further north.
And a bit further south. Why did the railroad stop is the question he's asking himself.
But what I have not seen, I haven't seen any Australian politician or much of the Australian security commentariat say, well, what about the rules-based global order?
What about sovereignty?
We've just spent decades writing strategic policy documents extolling the value of the rules-based global order, and almost that this is the world is inconceivable without it, that you can't have order.
In fact, a strategic priority for Australian governments for decades, including recent governments, has been to reinforce the rules-based global order. But here we have an incoming US president who is undercutting the basic principles of that rules-based global
order. But we have nothing to say about that.
No. And really, you've got to say that gives a whole lot of comfort and propaganda narrative to Xi Jinping, saying, well, I've got my own land grab in the South China Sea and about Taiwan. And Putin saying, gosh, you know, that Soviet Union wasn't such a bad idea. Why don't I get it back? It's very hard to see people sitting down with Donald Trump, Vladimir and Xi and saying sovereignty is so important. We must protect the territorial integrity of states like Panama, Canada, the Danes, the Ukrainians.
Well, I
and
agree.
The Taiwanese.
I mean, Xi Jinping will be saying, all I really want is people to acknowledge that the South China Sea, which is named the South China Sea, is Chinese. And I say that, and people heap all kinds of crap on me. But the Donald says that he's going to take Greenland, and nobody says a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is part of seeing what's happening rather than pretending it isn't happening. That's something that's important to do over this next 4 years.
Well, I'm a big fan of Noam Chomsky, and the poor guy had a massive stroke last year, and he's 96, so he probably won't be with us for much longer. But I think if he's capable of thought, I think he'd probably be going, see, I told you so.
Well, I'm not as big a fan as of Noam as you might be, but I do think living in the world and noticing what's actually happening is a good course of action. And noticing what's happening over the Christmas period, while I was frolicking about fishing on the south coast and watching my son at a cricket tournament in Orange, you luckily were manning the SAA global watch desk.
Somebody's got to hold the fort, Michael.
And you had, I think, one, two, three, four, and the last thing's a press release, but it's so important I'm going to count as number five. Five critical Australian government documents are released. So
what page count did you get to? I know you've been
I was up to 814 pages before these.
Yeah, so we're probably, I'd say, up now close to 1,000 pages of policy documents.
Just with the first one, we pretty much get
first
there, because the 2024 shipbuilding plan released just before the calendar turned over to 2025. The thing would have had to be pulped and reprinted if they'd waited a couple of days. That's about 150 pages.
The cynic in me, which is most of me actually, it was saying that's the only reason this thing appeared. The government had been promising to put out the shipbuilding plan in 2024, and they're looking at this thing and they're going, oh my god, we're going to have to pulp it and start all over again because we've only got a week until it becomes 2025.
But look, I thought the most important thing about the shipbuilding plan is it's not about shipbuilding. Whether ships actually end up turning out of this,
Ben Michael,
and whether the Navy gets a single ship out of this plan, when you read it, that's not the important thing.
Jobs.
This plan is all about steady state, long-term employment by a tiny number of Australians employed in what we laughingly call continuous shipbuilding. It's a job sustainment plan. It's not a shipbuilding plan.
Which we haven't actually done much of, because the first thing we did under the previous naval shipbuilding plan was to stop continuous naval shipbuilding.
Yes.
So, look, I think it's good that we have a document which essentially brings together all of the current government's commitments, which build on a lot of the previous government's commitments. So AUKUS, the Hunter catastrophe is still there, unfortunately, etc., etc. So it's all in one place, but I would still kind of describe this as a plan to have a plan rather than an actual plan, because a lot of the key building blocks of continuous naval shipbuilding are not discussed at all. Exhibit A, what does the Henderson shipyard look like? Who's going to own the shipyard in Henderson? So if I'm one of the competitors for the general purpose frigate program, and if we sort of go back to late last year, the government said we're down to the Japanese and Germans.
Yep.
They're going, I'm meant to build these ships in Western Australia at Henderson. Who owns the shipyard? Am I meant to build that shipyard? Does the government own it?
Well, that's not covered at all. Precinct being blown up and rebuilt around me while I'm trying to build these frigates?
So how do we build surface ships while we're doing sort of massive sustainment work on SSN? So a lot of the key questions just aren't really answered there at all.
No, a shipbuilding plan that doesn't say anything about is there actually going to be an East Coast submarine base? What kind of plan are we talking about here? So that's where I get back to this. It's an industry life support plan. It's not a shipbuilding plan. So that was the first one. The second one, the strategic review of the ADF reserves. Now, fortunately, I haven't read it, but you have?
Well, I've skimmed it, and I sort of kept skimming to try and find the strategic bit. So
it's in the title. It's the first word.
That's about all there is, because sort of the big strategic questions you'd be wanting to see something in there about, and that is, what role does the reserve play as part of mobilization?
So in a time of war, which apparently we're in the most dangerous period of our strategic history since the Second World War.
And there is apparently a real risk of major conflict in our region.
And in both the other major conflicts, World War One and World War Two, mobilization, bringing new people in, getting them into the military, training and equipping them, that was the big issue. So a strategic review of the ADF reserves must tangle with that.
Except it's pretty much silent on that. So
unfortunate.
Yeah, to me, this is basically yet another kind of business as usual review, not a strategic re-examination of key policy settings. It's basically saying we have a very small professional ADF and we want to sort of get a little bit better at how we slot the reserves into that
this
small
little machine.
Professional ADF. So here's some suggestions about personnel management, some suggestions about recruitment, some suggestions about how we tap into some of the skills in the broader Australian population. Mm. But there's nothing really in there about that, the big M word. How do we grow from where we are now to an ADF that may need to be hundreds and hundreds of thousands if we look at, say, a conflict like Ukraine?
An order of magnitude bigger than the current professional force. Yes, so that's a fail as a strategic review. In fact, I think on numbers, it's so underwhelming. It says, well, we'll increase the number in the reserves by about 1,000 between now and 2030, which is, I mean, it's so underwhelming, it's embarrassing to see in the review.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at that and went, surely you can't be serious. Like, even for the sake of and having some kind of announceable, we are going to grow by 1,000 people over the next 5 years.
Particularly when you're in a workforce crisis with the permanent force, you'd think that there'd be some sense of, you know, the emergency button has been hit and we're trying to at least grow the reserve.
I mean, that shows we are not thinking about anything fundamentally different here.
No, I keep thinking about the Chief of Army or that speech he gave towards the end of last year, talking about the virtue of having a tiny military and how agile it was. And I was thinking, but you know, he must know, if there is actually a major war, that's not a virtue. That's a fundamental weakness. But that weakness pervades this review of the reserves. The next one, a personal favourite, I read the whole thing and I got, I think, corrosively disappointed as I went through. And that's the Varghese review of funding to think tanks and universities to do what the review laughingly calls strategic policy research. Because the net effect of this review by a former secretary is to make sure that no new thinking comes out of universities or think tanks that causes the mandarins, the current secretaries who are doing Peter Varghese's job now, any discomfort. I know you've written something and we'll get it out on the site, all this window dressing about how much he admires contestability and new ideas is all then suffocated by the clawing hand of the powerful policy mandarins who don't like another voice and what they call governance, which is also known as control by the public service.
Yes, well, if I can just step back, the document we're talking about is the Independent Review of Commonwealth Funding for Strategic Policy Work.
We'll put a link in.
It's quite a mouthful, also known as the Varghese Review after its author, Peter Varghese, also known in the media as the Get Aspie Review. Oh, I'm not sure if it's really the Get Aspie Review, but I would agree with you, Michael, that this is just, again, business as usual. I'm not actually sure what problem they're trying to fix. I mean, it's not in the terms of reference, really. Mr. Varghese does say, well, contestability is a very good thing. Mandarins love to say that.
Yep.
And we need more external contestability.
Absolutely. He says it's that very clearly.
Very clearly. Yep. But then nothing he recommends actually will improve that at all.
Well, it'll silence it. It'll do the opposite. So I've seen him write in defense of his review and say, but I said in the review how important contestability was. Yes, Mr. Varghese, you said how important it was, but everything you did in the review will reduce it. So don't give me the fig leaf.
Well, everything, all of the recommendations essentially come down to the Mandarin's favorite trick. And I would say that certainly in the national security space, the Mandarins have been a one-trick pony, which is, oh, it doesn't matter what the problem is, more supervision by the Mandarins through SCONS, the Secretary's Committee on National Security. If everything comes through SCONS, we'll fix every single problem because we'll have more coordination, you know, more supervision.
And the wise owls of the secretaries will, because they're right about everything. They've been so right about so many things. That's why we have such a vibrant economy here in Australia, and that's why we don't have a housing crisis.
Such a great housing market, such great, you know, energy policy.
A sustainable tax base to support government spending. Yeah. All brought
manufacturing
to us
sector.
By these
Mandarins have done so well. So now they want to control contestability. Now both you and I have been SES officers, Senior Executive Service officers, inside the Department of Defence doing contestability. And even inside the department, it's pretty clear the Mandarins don't really want contestability. Now, they want a bit of polishing of the policy before it goes to government, but they certainly don't want annoying people questioning the fundamentals of the policy.
Well, I got a funny story about an unnamed deputy secretary who is the biggest fan of contestability division's work, strong supporter, always spoke up and supported the work, said wonderful analysis and a really hard edge, but yeah, these are the hard questions, great work, until the division reviewed a project that deputy secretary was responsible for and pointed out some extreme risks, which I note have all come to pass. And then he called me up and yelled at me and tried to intimidate me and told me how it was all terrible and how dare I criticise the project that he was responsible for. So everybody loves contestability until it happens to them.
And I'll just point out that the fundamental, I would say, blindness in the Varghese review is that he criticises one single individual.
Who?
Our colleague and former boss, Peter Jennings.
Yes, well, he's committed, hasn't he committed two crimes?
Yes, op-ed overreach.
Well, he's committed the crime of having an opinion and the second crime of op-ed overreach. Now, the first crime of having an opinion, only Mandarins are allowed to have opinion.
Yes.
And when they have an opinion, it's called advice.
Yes.
So that's a good thing. And then op-ed overreach is an even worse crime because that means not only did Mr. Jennings have the gall to have an opinion on an issue, like Darwin Port maybe, or the 5G
network.
But it
was different from the Mandarins.
Different, and he had a public platform to use that voice.
But the,
so that's there are two crimes there.
You've missed the fundamental crime, which is to people actually listened to his quote op-ed overreach, and it may have even indeed shaped government opinion. I mean, AUKUS, for example, AUKUS, like it or not, is about countering
China's power
and its attempt to overturn the current security order.
I think Mr. Jennings has to get into that. You know, Roy and HG always talk about the room full of mirrors. He needs to go into that room full of mirrors and take a good hard look at himself. And Mr. Varghese, in his nakedly personal criticism of Peter Jennings, may have diminished himself as a public figure, but I think Peter really needs to look at himself. How dare he have...
Sorry, which Peter?
Peter Jennings.
PJ.
How dare he have informed opinions and how dare he voice them publicly? And the good news is the Varghese review is putting a stop to all that nonsense.
Because the Mandarins will now be sitting on top of the whole contestability
people.
System.
And in fact, the Mandarins love contestability so much, they know that it thrives on information. So the next thing that came out over the Christmas New Year period was the review of defence major projects by the ANAO. And Yes. If you did believe in Condestable, you'd get even more information in that report every time, wouldn't you? Did we get more information about major projects in this or less?
I think you know the answer to this, Michael. It is indeed less. So, yes, these two reports came out within a day of each other, I believe. So the Varghese Review and the latest Australian National Audit Office annual review of major projects, major acquisition projects by the Department.
So with the Varghese Review, we saw what the Mandarins profess they like, which is contestability and good public information. With the ANAO Major Projects Review,
we saw what
Mandarins actually do, which is provide less information to allow less contestability.
Yes, because the Auditor General had to write in the Major Projects Report that the Secretary of Defence has said that the Department would no longer release a lot of information that it had previously released. This is because of our very serious security situation, which has changed dramatically, and because of this, the Department of Defense will no longer release schedule information around major projects.
But that's a key metric of performance, isn't it? Like, there's cost, schedule, and performance. That's it.
What's your point?
So you cannot assess performance if you don't have schedule.
No. So the ANAO said this. They can no longer actually say whether a project is on schedule or not because the department is not releasing IOC dates, so initial operating capability dates, and full operating capability dates. So that is, those are the mileposts against which you assess schedule.
Yeah.
We can't do that. So even though we are now, according to the Secretary of Defence, in these terrible strategic circumstances, the Australian public has no way of knowing whether the hundreds of billions of dollars that is being spent on capability is actually delivering anything in a meaningful time frame.
And, you know, this justification about, well, the reason I can't tell you what I've told you for decades about project performance in defence is it's a dangerous strategic time. The Pentagon is still disclosing reams of this stuff, far greater levels of detail. So that strategic rationale is an utter nonsense.
It is an utter nonsense. And it gets it to the heart of the difference between our system and the US system, where Congress insists on prerogatives and passes legislation mandating not only the disclosure of information, but setting up organisations like the very, very capable Congressional Budget Office and Congressional Research Service, which have a mandate to examine and publish on those things.
Well, and I remember powerful US Congress people writing about the US Navy and its failure to provide information to allow members of Congress to be informed about US shipbuilding and submarine program. They were so incensed at the lack of information, and they still got reams of it compared to what our parliament gets, that they wrote a public letter condemning the US Navy. Wouldn't it be great to see some of our parliamentarians realise they should be treated with respect by our bureaucracy?
But they should direct the Mandarins to disclose, because the fundamental point is the Mandarins say one thing, they do something fundamentally different.
And that's what the ANAO report shows us them doing, despite what Mr. Varghese professes he loves.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the last thing, it's not a review, it's only a page and a half, but it's a wonderful...
It sort of wraps up 2024,
it does. It's
the achievements of the Albanese government.
Yeah, and it's apparently Mr. Conroy, this is his release.
Minister for Defence Industry.
30th of December, and it's a wonderful description of acceleration.
The cusp of the end of the year, yes.
So,
what is the title of this review?
Albanese government accelerates defence capability delivery as part of commitment to safer Australia. It's only part of the commitment, by the way.
So, accelerates.
For those who've listened to our previous podcasts, acceleration in Australian government language, particularly defence language, doesn't mean what you think it means. But in the case of Mr. Conroy's confection of acceleration achievements, acceleration means if anything happened in 2024, then it was acceleration.
And not just any kind of acceleration, but acceleration caused by the Albanese government.
Yes, yes. So the final delivery of the last of three squadrons worth of F-35.
So the last nine of 72.
Yeah, that's accelerification by Mr. Conroy, apparently. It's not because they cancelled buying a fourth squadron, so they did actually get the fleet faster because they got less.
Now, these last aircraft were delivered in 2024. If I cast my mind back, Michael, I think that project was started in the year 2002. So they 22 years.
Well, it's sustained acceleration, isn't it?
One of my first jobs in defence was to write the first pass cabinet submission for the acquisition of the F-35. That was 2006. So I'm 18 years
ago. Even earlier, I think I was working for Alan Hawke when they decided they weren't going to keep looking at global options.
So yeah. That's been accelerated along with, so three new missile types were fired from Navy ships, so Tomahawk, SM-6 and Naval Strike Missile.
You know, the funny thing about that, so we've fired Tomahawk and SM-6 from a Navy ship. That Navy ship is going offline into deep refit, but also we don't have anything, any of either of those missiles.
I don't believe we have any.
So we've accelerated so fast, we don't have any.
But the other thing about that is those missiles were all announced by the previous government.
Yeah.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
Construction commenced on the first Hunter-class frigate. Well, if that's your idea of acceleration, I mean, what can I say?
Well, acceleration, I was reading, it was a Zimbabwean English dictionary, and it found an alternate meaning of acceleration meant the slow congealment.
Mm.
So I think it's that meaning that of acceleration. Meaning.
Okay, well, it's good to know what definition of acceleration we're using.
It's an archaic use that's no longer common.
Mm-hmm. Two shipbuilders were selected to progress designs for the general purpose frigate, a new program announced in 2024. You know, I'll give them that. I think there is glimmers there of potentially something happening a little bit faster than usual.
But this is what do you measure it against? So against the slow congealing of the disaster that is the Hunter frigate, yes, the general purpose frigate does appear to be moving faster, but it's a bit like a race between a legless cockroach and an ailing slug.
Well, they have made some decisions, which is good, but even if those decisions kind of come to fruition, we're still looking at 2029 for the first ship, so we're still 5 years away, but that is faster than the congealing Hunter one.
Yep,
so,
yep.
All right.
Let's not go through them all, because they got some new tanks. Great. Yep, good.
Previous government decision, though.
They selected a ship design for the landing craft Heavy. Well, that's just process wending along its careful, slow way.
We've now got 10 Black Hawk helicopters. As we have considered and discussed a number of times, that project has actually gone slower since Minister Miles said he was personally going to accelerate it.
Yes. Well, maybe Mr. Conroy can meet with Pete Hesketh, the new Pentagon head, and further accelerate it so that it doesn't take until 2030 to get 40 helicopters off a mature production line.
Yes, well,
maybe we can get them by 2045.
The 2030 is the date that the government's own date. Look, the only other one I'll mention is we got the first Triton. So high altitude, long endurance UAV.
Are they still making those?
Well, the US has decided it's going to stop making them. It'll give us our last four and then it's shutting everything down. So we're getting four at a cost of $3 billion. Again, that's a program we've been in and out of since the 20th century.
Yeah, yeah.
We still don't even have initial operating capability. So
it's hilarious, isn't it? The Hunter and the Triton, if ever you had a shred of credibility about talking about acceleration, you would not include those two programs.
No. So anyway, our next episode, I think we're going to be talking about the year to come. Hopefully, this media release on the cusp of New Year's Eve is not going to really be the nature of 2025 in the Australian defence space. I have to say I'm a little sceptical.
I'm going to be really charitable. What I think Pat Conroy was really doing with this media release was closing the door on 2024 and all the superficial glib nonsense about their historic accelerification and grand achievements. He wanted to finish that off and start the new year with honesty and objective analysis for the Australian people. So I'm looking forward to his first press release in 2025.
I love your optimism, young man. But look, the good news is if people think we're too hard on Minister Conroy, the good news is that on the 19th of February at the ADM Annual Congress, he will be speaking as the keynote speaker first thing in the morning, and the grumpy strategist will be speaking after lunch. So you'll be able to compare and contrast the two different views.
Yeah. Well, Marcus, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.